and welcome to Dialect. I'm Angela Balassi. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. This week, we will be speaking to a mason about the oaths, ceremonies and secrecy around the craft. Joanne Fowler will be talking about her campaign to win terminally ill patients a pain-free death after her father's agony in his dying days. Maurice Kirk will be talking about his round-the-world trip in a World War II aeroplane. And Carol Paul will be talking about her poetry at Glastonbury Fringe Festival. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you would like to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. Freemasonry is one of the world's oldest fraternal organisations, which traces its origin to the stonemasons. It has long been shrouded in mystery, but books such as Martin Short's Inside the Brotherhood and Stephen Knight's The Brotherhood, which is a prequel, say there is evidence it is a cult and has been linked to corruption. We talked to John Tiley, who is a mason, to find out more. Hello, John. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Angela. Thanks.
Firstly, how long have you been a mason?
I joined in Australia in 1987.
And why did you join?
I had a father figure mentor by the name of Stan Brown, who was in his 70s at the time. He was in the paratroopers that landed at Arnhem, and he is renowned if you know that era, and there are books like First In that he was involved, he was in.
So he was inspirational to you?
He was a wonderful man, yeah, and I loved being out with him at dinner and things like that. He was a tremendous raconteur. I really loved the bloke, and I asked him about the masonry and joined in Australia.
And what do you like about it?
For me, personally, it's a great hobby with a moral code that that knocks some of the, you know, metaphorically speaking, from a symbolism point of view, knocks the rough edges off over a period of time. I like the nice regimental dinners, and I like the fact that we collectively raise money for charity, which is, as you know, close to my heart.
And which lodge are you a member of?
I'm a member of Powell Lodge in the province of Bristol.
And how many are there in Bristol?
Lodges?
Mm-hmm.
36. In the province of Bristol, which is the old city and county of Bristol, the provinces of Freemasonry, I think, are roughly that. Bristol was the city and county, so that is a province.
Okay. And can you tell me who the other members are of Powell Lodge?
I think a lot of that is in the public domain. If you go on provinceofbristol.org.uk, you can find out quite a lot of information. I've found out, but it would be rather bad form of me to inform anybody of who else is in the club, as it were. With that's up to them. You know, so I'd feel the same about my tennis club. So.
Okay, but there seems to be more secrecy around masonry compared to, say, tennis clubs or other sports clubs. Why do you think there is that secrecy?
I don't know, to be honest. So I can give an opinion, and that is that in times gone by, when this was Freemasonry is an historical thing, and I'm not qualified enough to know the history. Lodge mentors might, and the province mentors would know. But back in the days gone by, it would have been to protect their livelihood and their work and their savings and money. And because back in, say, the Cornish mining days, a lot of miners would join the craft, knowing that they would be looked after. Their families would be looked after in the event of a death.
Is it still the case that you look after each other today?
Yes, You would if the man was worthy, and there's means testing and things like that, because there is, you know, Freemasonry gives more money to charity than anybody else in the UK other than the National Lottery, and So, if I fell on hard times, Freemasonry would have some means of supporting my family.
But is it also a case of doing favours for each other?
I wouldn't. I can't possibly. Some people might do that, I don't know. But that is really, you know, it depends what the favour is, doesn't it? You know, doing my garden is one thing, but helping me break the law would be another, and one is might be condoned and breaking the law wouldn't. So the favouritism thing is an interesting concept, but that's masonry, that's networking, isn't it? People network, and once they know people, then they know them, and they might favour them over someone they don't know in a similar situation. Certainly there is no there's no edict or mandate to say thou must do that, because clearly you can't support someone doing something wrong.
Okay, in the books such as by Martin Short, they report on corruption connected to the police.
Yes.
Is the corruption something you've come across in Masonry?
I'll rephrase that answer. It's not something that I'm aware of or am involved in, or I would be mortified if anybody even suggested that in my dealings and the people I know within it. But that's not to say that certain people in any club, and certainly Masonry has got that, they have bent the rules and they've done wrong. I can't argue with that, but I certainly don't condone it. You know, it's wrong, and that's bad form. Wrong. That's just my view.
Okay, and how do you join? Is it a case of you have to be invited?
No. Funnily enough, it's you should ask. You just ask, and you say I'll receive that. There's if you go on provinceofbristol.org.uk, you'll see they tell you how to join. But if basically it's asking someone you know.
And is it a case of you pay a subscription?
Yeah, if you join, you join the club or lodge that you want to join, and.
And how much is a subscription as average?
It does vary. It does vary from lodge to lodge or club to club, depending on how often they meet. But in our lodge, it's £100 or so to join. Bearing in mind, I've been here a long time. £100 or so to join initially, and then I think it's about £160 a year hours, and that's around about normal.
And what kind of people join? What backgrounds are they from, or industries?
Well, that's the fascinating thing, that the cross-section of people I've met in my time in the craft has been fascinating. You know, we've got brain surgeons, pilots, heart surgeons, lorry drivers, stonemasons, road diggers. We've got quite a lot. It's a big spread. Sikhs, Muslims, you know, really, I find it fascinating. And so it is a cross-section of society, of male society. And it's the moral aspect of it, you know, and the moral counsel of older, because the demographic of people is older, I find really helpful.
And are women allowed to join?
They're not allowed to join currently our lodges, although there is a very very active women's Freemasonry. It's very active in the West Country. I know it's very active out of Bath, for example, but I can't join it because I'm a man.
Okay. And I understand there's a cross-section of society, but if you have to pay a certain amount of money, I imagine still it's going to be people with money. Is that fair to say?
Well, certainly it's people are going to afford to pay £160. Yeah, and I think, you know, because that's not only it, you know, you pay for, in Bristol, Bristol's is unique. It is very, very nice in terms of, it's got one of the best bars in the centre of Bristol, so it's a really nice bar, which people can use if they're not Masons, but they can, but they need to come in with a Mason. And it's got a fantastic restaurant. Fantastic restaurant in there, with three or four dining rooms. Wonderful facility, and but it, you know, like a meal might cost us £17.
And if people pay for this, is it a case of they want to progress their careers or their businesses?
Well, some might, Angela. You know, in my experience, I've got nothing out of it since 1987. So in but that's never been, because that wasn't my objective, you know, so I'm not stressed about that. But that's not to say that some people join to further their careers to meet, to, you know, like, you know, if you're an IFA, you might do that. Mm. A car salesman, you might do that. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't, but that's not helped me. And
can you tell me about the oaths?
Yeah, well, it's an oath of, you know, it's very much like you're taking a courtroom, you know, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Well, that's based on, so it's based on symbolism from the past, and it's all about doing the right thing, and it's a test of character, really.
And I know there's been a case of the oath, one where they refer to, you know, should I do a wrongdoing that I should slit my throat. Is that correct?
No, it's not. To be absolutely correct, in the oath, I think it refers to in former times, the oath that you're taking would have meant if you didn't live up to it, you would have your throat slit. But that's it. But that was in former times. I can't imagine that was ever done, but certainly it's not. It is in former times, the oath you've taken, you would have your throat slit if you didn't live up to it.
And there are also lots of signs. I mean, I know we're on radio, but is it possible to give an example of one of the signs?
Well, it's perfect to do it on radio, isn't it?
So it's still secret.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's... the good thing about Freemasonry is that as a demographic of society, the craft hasn't been growing by the same rate as the population of blokes. Okay, so... But I still think that the moral code is quite a handy thing. Yes, there might be Masons that you wouldn't want to, that you can't trust. But as a demographic, there's a better chance. So if you go to other parts of the world, or a city, or anywhere else in the world, I could go up, wander up into a lodge, and I would be looked after, and then I would have to prove that I'm a Mason. And proving Masons would have, you know, handshakes and words and signs, One would look a bit of a fool to actually try and bluff and blag your way into a certain level, and that some might.
And could you tell me what the handshake is?
Yeah. It's I can show you because we're on radio, and that's only part of it. It's
okay.
Only part of it. You're going to have to, you know, it talks about signs, tokens and words, and what it means is signs and tokens are the handshake, which is different levels, and the word is different.
Okay.
The word is different.
Because there's a lot of symbolism in Masonry as well. I mean, for example, you talk about on the square, is that correct, on the level?
Yeah, on the square, it's all about doing the right thing, do unto others as want to be done do unto yourself, and I think a little bit of symbolism was the analogy of a piece of stone as a person starts rough, and then over a period of time with chisel and mallet, that stone is turned into a block, and it talks about I can give you a little bit of inside information, and that is say, the working tools of an entered apprentice, so the mallet and chisel and the 24-inch gauge. Now, that's a proper stonemason apprentice. The mallet and chisel are used by that mason to strike off all rude and imperfect parts of the stone. But we, as speculative masons, apply them to strike off all rude and imperfect parts of our thoughts and actions. By the mallet, we learn that skill without exertion is of little avail, and that labour is the lot of man, and from the chisel that perseverance is necessary to establish perfection, and the 24-inch gauge is used by the mason to measure his work, and we apply it to our time. So what happens there is that's just gives you a bit of symbolism, let's say, that's how you might want to conduct yourself. You know, now it goes on from there.
There are others which say that it's not a moral code of conduct, but it's in fact a religious cult. What would you say to that?
I did have an interesting discussion out there about that. It's certainly not a religious cult. Well, I'll rephrase that. It has a moral, a religious ethos to it, because they talk about the sacred law, which is about, in the Christian's case, the Bible, and in a Muslim's case, is the Quran, and those volumes of the sacred law are in the lodges. But you have to swear by whoever you believe, you know. So that's that. With masonry, the higher you go, in my opinion, it gets more and more Christian in its ethos. And whilst I hear accusations about in the higher echelons, it worships the occult, I would be mortified if I was supporting that. Mortified. And I wouldn't be involved.
Finally, how do you rise up the ranks?
Symbolically, it's all about constant trial and approval, okay? And you get given parts to play in the symbolism of the rituals, which are, I've read a little bit of the script out. And if you learn those, you, in front of, say, 40 or 60 other blokes, you look okay. If you don't learn them, you don't really look okay. What happens is, Angela, you still pass to the next level, you know, and because it's all about the inner self, you know. If I make a mistake, you know, it's like you know, and during your job, you do your job, and if you want to do it the best you can, and that's how you do it. You take on roles and you pass it.
Well, thank you, John, and I look forward to learning more about that handshake. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
We'll be talking to Joanne Fowler, whose war hero father died in such agony that he tore off his own clothes. She's now campaigning for terminally ill people to have the right to a pain-free death. Frank Foster was battling a fatal brain tumour and admitted to Tunbridge Wells Hospital, Kent, in May of last year, and he died on June 13, 2014. Joanne said her father, who was shot while serving in the King's Royal Rifle Corps in 1942, would have suffered less had he died in the battlefield. Welcome, Joanne.
Hello.
Firstly, just to clarify, you were campaigning for the right to a pain-free death rather than...
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. My father had a week to live. That week should have been pain-free. Instead, he was transported to the worst pain known to man.
Could you tell me a little bit more about this experience, please?
Well, yes. His pain was the worst pain you can imagine is what my father suffered. And my father was also deaf and blind. We were told that my father would be kept comfortable and stress-free. The hospital found no neglect of my dad, so what you hear in the recordings that I have are normal up and down our country. He suffered like nobody should suffer, and what I witnessed was so barbaric. I swore that when my father died in my arms, that his suffering will never be in vain. I recorded his suffering. Thank God I did, because if I hadn't, his suffering would have been another untold story, a horror story. And his suffering now has to be played, because it's the reality of what is going on up and down our country, and something has to be done about it.
And part of the recordings, you say that he was tearing his clothes off in agony on a soaked bed. Is that right?
Yes, he was. He was. It was the most distressing scene. It was a scene I would describe as slow execution. That's how I would describe it. We kept my mother away from the hospital because we didn't want Mum to see my dad like that. He was so bad. But she came up and I said, Mum, you don't want to see this. And she came in and she was absolutely beside herself. My dad was screaming in the worst pain known to man, I've been told, is what he would have suffered. And I am so angry that he was allowed to suffer like this. And this suffering was avoidable. He didn't have to suffer like this, and not all people do suffer like this.
Okay, and we have one of the clips in which 93-year-old Frank Foster is heard moaning loudly and groaning in pain as he lies in a hospital bed.
He's just got to have pain relief.
Joanne, why did you decide to make these recordings?
I decided to make them because I was witnessing something so barbaric. My darling father, the dearest, sweetest man, who was the most, he was kind and caring and gentle. He never complained. He was blind and deaf, but he never complained about being blind and deaf. His thoughts were always for others, and he still said, life is good. He was ready to pass away. He had suffered enough, and my father came, my brother came over from Germany, saw my dad distressed, and he was in tears seeing his father like that. And my father wanted to give my brother his wedding ring that was given to him on his father's deathbed, but my brother didn't take it. He just felt the time wasn't right. And when my brother had gone, my father looked above and said, I'm ready. He couldn't take any more suffering. Little did he know that 3 days later, he was going to be transported to the worst pain imaginable. And what I witnessed, something in my brain, I knew I had to get recordings of this because I could not believe that this was happening. I thought the public have got to know what is going on. And I have to have proof of what is going on.
The hospital did launch an independent investigation.
Yes, they did.
They found there was no robust end-of-life plan for Frank,
yes,
which
they
would
did.
Have significantly improved.
They found that there was a doctor on the ward who was asked to see my father, who failed to. No explanation of why. But I think, really, the report has to be forgotten now.
Okay, but we have to give them their right to reply.
So
they concluded
no evidence of neglect, and that is the bottom line. I know the report is totally flawed. I believe every single penny of the £11,000 that was spent on that report should be actually donated to Hospice in the World because it's a scandal. The report is a scandal. The fact that my father, they can say he was not neglected, is a scandal.
It was said in their statement they did acknowledge that they could have done more.
Yes, they could have
and
done.
And they said that, you know, they were sorry that this was not the case.
Yes.
What do you hope to do now?
I hope to do now is to have these recordings played in Parliament.
The recordings of your...
by David Cameron, the man who runs this country, the country my father fought for.
I say, just to clarify.
Now, just for men like my father.
Just to clarify, you mean the recordings of your father in agony?
The recordings I have, the evidence I have of my father's last days on this earth, that so many other people are suffering the same as my dad. I have had emails from all over the country, messages from all over the country, to say, this same thing happened to my dad, my mum, my sister, my brother, and they've had enough. I've had letters from, emails from nurses, from doctors in pain management. They are ashamed to call themselves a nurse when they have listened to my recordings and they have said they have seen enough. I had one nurse say to me, I could write a book on the suffering that I have seen in the National Health Service. If I had not had these recordings, this would have gone untold. My dad's suffering has got to be put to good use. It has to be put to good use. It's got to avoid the same thing happening to others. This is why I have my campaign. I need signatures on my campaign for David Cameron to listen to my recordings, to debate my recordings, and to have something done that people are not allowed, it will be criminal, a criminal offence for anybody to be left to suffer like my dad was.
So ultimately you'd like David Cameron to have this issue brought up in Parliament, is that
absolutely
correct?
Absolutely. I want him to listen to my father's recording, and he should, because my father is the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, and ultimately, would you like more assisted help, more for assisted dying?
My father had a week to live, and it should have been pain-free. Anybody in this day and age should not be suffering at the end of their life, but they are suffering. They are suffering right now as we are talking.
I imagine this is obviously very traumatic. You knew that your father was dying, but then to see him in such pain must have added to that pain for you as well.
Of course. Well, my heart broke. My heart broke. Seeing my father, my wonderful father, suffering like that, and I was begging and pleading for somebody to please come and help me. They threatened to throw me out of the hospital because I was begging for pain relief for my father. I had to call the hospice from the hospital to beg them. They were so kind to me, to beg them to tell the hospital what to do to put my father out of pain. And the hospice did that. The hospice actually rung the hospital and they told them what to do. Because, you know, I think about the people who don't have a family member. And there are many more that don't have a family member that do. If my dad hadn't had me there with him,
okay,
he would have been alone.
I understand you've now launched a petition and you have over 9,000 people who have signed it.
That's right, yes. Where can people... It's a one-woman petition, a daughter fighting for her father's suffering not to have been in vain, but to help other people. I do need to stress very, very strongly, we have never wanted one penny in compensation. The only compensation I want is that my father did not suffer in vain and that his suffering will leave a legacy that he helped other people.
And where can people go to support this campaign?
They can go to my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/joanne.fowler.3152. I can also be found on Twitter, which is JoJoJoFowler.
Okay. Thank you, Joanne, for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on your programme.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Today we're with Maurice Kirk, who is a veterinary surgeon who once operated on Oliver Reed. Now he's planning to fly around the world in a World War II Cub. That's a two-seater Piper plane. Hello, Maurice. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. You said plane. A plane is for smoothing a piece of wood. I learnt to fly at Filton Airfield, which just happens to be up the road from here. And the squadron leader hit me across the back of the head for using that word. It is an aircraft or an aeroplane. Okay, enough lectures. Carry on.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And why have you decided to take up this venture?
Well, I like breaking the bonds of Earth. I learnt to fly at Filton, where I met Brian Trebshaw, because we were watching the design and building of the Concorde. So we're talking 1963-64. But I remember the squadron leader hitting me across the back of the head in a DH Chipmunk, which was the standard RAF training two-seat aircraft in those days. Do you realise that I flew one of those? I was the first to fly under the Severn Bridge. I think I'm old enough now to give away a few secrets. But we waited in 1967, I think it was, where the centre part of the old bridge, not the new one, the old bridge... And it was in inclement weather. But I remember managing to do the feat with RAF markings, and I never heard a word.
First of all, could you tell me why you're doing this?
It's wonderful up there, and it's always changing. The scenery is changing. I am in love with old aircraft, as old as me, and preferably older than me. Pre-war. But this Piper Cub was used in the D-Day landings, and my first Piper Cub, Golf Kilo India Romeo Kilo, that's G-K-I-R-K, sadly finished up in the Caribbean. Now, I've talked about all this last time, and I think I left the United States in chains for landing the next Cub too close to the President's Ranch. But this one is Golf Kilo Uniform Romeo Kilo, so G. Kirk. I have three. You can guess the registration of the other one. And she's ready. We've just test flown her in Hampshire, and we're just preparing her to fly down to South Africa. I'm very frightened of the sea, and I get lost very easily. So the way I'm going to do it is get down to Gibraltar, and then fly around with the water on my right-hand side, because then I can't get lost. As long as... And I've always got a beach to land on. That's my master plan.
But it's a two-seater. Will you be travelling alone?
Unfortunately, there won't be space for anyone else, but this time I am leaving the front seat in. But I usually have to carry a lot of equipment, extra fuel, because she only carries a 12-gallon... Well, a 10-gallon tank, because in the D-Day landings, they were brought over in boxes after the D-Day, you know, a week after the D-Day landings. The ships were going into the Mulberry docks there on Aramanche, and they were unloading on sort of quarter of a mile out to sea, putting the wings on and flying these little aircraft off a 200-foot wooden strip off the deck. But they were used, and they only had a short tank, a short-range tank, and they were used by General Patton, who was known to fly them, because he was a pilot, to carry the messages between the battalions, the tanks regiments, all the way up through to Paris and to Berlin. And they were designed to land in the snow, on the roads, in ploughed fields, and really a rather lot of fun.
Okay. And what about the safety of these planes? If they're older, does that mean they're less safe?
Well, I was taught at Filton by the RAF. I had a short-term commission in the reserve. And I think when I left, I was very privileged. I mean, I actually got paid 12 shillings a day to learn to fly at the taxpayer's expense. And that fueled my 25-shilling Austin 7, which I bought down in the docks of Bristol. And petrol, of course, was only 4 shillings and 6p. If anything I remember about aviation is, look after thine airflow, lest the ground come up and smite thee. When your engine stops, when the donkey stops, it gets very quiet. And what you must always do is fly the aeroplane. If the aeroplane doesn't fly if it above a certain speed, which is the stall speed, it just drops out of the sky. And in panic situation, which is usually follows an engine stop, people are known to fly too slowly when there's plenty of places to land, but they are panicking because of the circumstances. And sadly, but I hope I've got it right. I've had 14 engine failures, and I'm hoping the 15th will be as successful as the last. Some of them were quite notorious, but it would take a week to give you those stories.
Are you a little bit nervous about this?
No, at my age, I've run out of being nervous. No, but when I flew the aircraft, the G. Kirk, the first one, to Australia, it was a very safe flight. There were parts of it where I landed in the jungle and on the beach in the West Indies, East Indies. I finished up with lots of people who couldn't speak English. I can't understand why, but there we are. This time I'm going to Africa, and as you know, as we watch the news, my joke about keeping the water on my right-hand side may be okay, but I actually have to plan my route according to the politics of that month. I may be, in fact, going straight down the centre. I want to do certain things. I want to land her on tabletop.
Okay. And you've already travelled to Australia. And where next? Where after South Africa?
My dream is to get there, sample the very good wine that they make on the east coast of South Africa, and ship her to the Falklands. Because when my dear old Liberty Girl, who got me to Australia, New Zealand and Japan, sank in the Caribbean when I was on the way to the Falkland Islands, I swore that I would come back and get to the Falkland Islands before the Argies take our oil. After that, my swan song, because I'll be a lot older by then, I want to fly. I was a climbing instructor for a long time in North Wales. So I do want to fly slowly up the Andes, up to the Mexican border, and I'm going to ask the next president, whoever it's going to be, and there are lots in choice at the moment, I notice, to say, please, sir, madam, can I come back? Because at the moment I'm banned from America for this nonsense story that I had landed on President Bush's front lawn.
When was that?
That was 5 years ago.
And it's nonsense, you say?
Absolute nonsense, because I landed in a farmer's field, beautiful flowers. On my website, there are lovely pictures of the aeroplane sitting with a bunch of flowers with black and white dairy cows.
So why do they think you'd landed in Bush's garden?
Well, the trouble was, I wanted to thank President Bush for saving my life, because when G. Kirk, my English aircraft, ditched off the Caicos Islands, I was getting very cold. It was getting dark, and I was in my shorts. And after 3 hours, a helicopter came out, and Julie, the pilot, dropped a rope and saved my life. And I quickly bought another cub, because they are extremely of low price over there, and set off for the Falkland Islands via Mexico. But I went across Texas, and I saw this great big prohibited area. Well, that, of course, attracted attention. I wanted to know what it was. And, of course, I landed and found out that it was President Bush's area. But I never landed into it, otherwise a SAM missile. There was a rumour that an F-16 had its engines running at 32 miles away on a runway, because this cub was flying around the edge. It's all been blown out of all proportion. But the reason why I think I was arrested was because I got out of the aeroplane and decided to walk the last 4 miles. But I was dressed in shorts with a hunting top hat, Taunton Vale foxhounds, and I think there might have been a little thing which said 10 and 6 pence stuck in it. And I did have a camera because I was interested in the bird life. Beautiful, beautiful Texas. This was very lush and green. And being a country boy, I was fascinated.
Okay, just to check, do you plan to drop in on anybody on this journey?
Well, you know, we live by the moment, don't we? there are lots of areas of Africa that I learnt about at Taunton School. I was very good at geography. It was my best subject, but I wasn't allowed to use it. I became a veterinary surgeon instead and a commercial pilot. But there are parts of Africa I would personally love to visit. You cannot envisage until you're there smelling the flowers. And
are there any people you would like to visit?
Oh, well, I've become very involved with Nigerians. I've been representing a Nigerian family in the family court, which has become quite well known, the Musa case. And I've met a lot of very wonderful Nigerians, and I have promised to visit their villages. The aircraft can land almost anywhere, tennis court, if the wind's in the right direction, as long as you take the net down in the middle, and get out. You never land an aircraft unless you can sure you can get out.
Thank you, Maurice. I'm afraid that's all we have time for this evening.
Thank you very much.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
We're here with poet Carol Paul, who will be performing at the Glastonbury Fringe Festival. Hello, Carol. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's fun.
And what attracts you to this festival?
I spend part of my time in Glastonbury, and I've been there for a few years now, and it is such an amazing place to live and spend time. It's completely... Sometimes it's quite wacky and it's wonderful. It's got lots of history and mystery, and it really is just a fun place.
And what will you be performing?
I've got lots of stories about Glastonbury. I also make puppets and take them out entertaining. And I have two very large dragons.
And could you tell us a bit more about the dragons?
I had them made a few years ago just for fun. They're 2 metres from nose to tail. And they form characters in my stories, so I take them out storytelling. I've taken them to different events, and people say, wow, is it real? And what's it made of? And I say, well, it's a dragon. Dragons are made of dragon.
Okay. And your poetry, I understand it varies from the serious to the light-hearted to plain funny. Could you give us an example, please?
Well, I've been writing poetry for years, and a lot of my poetry started off helping people deal with grief. So my poems for funerals and so on have gone around the world. And then I started feeling that I needed to do some more fun stuff. So now I write a lot of comic poetry and I go out performing that. And I write a lot about Glastonbury. For example, one that goes down very well in the town is this one. Can I read it to you?
Yes, please.
Okay. And it's actually a lot of the questions that people ask about the legends of Glastonbury. So I've done it in a question form. Glastonbury has a history of magic, myth and mystery. But is it fact or is it fiction? Does its water cure affliction? Did Jesus come and sweetly smile on what was known as Avalon's Isle? Did his uncle plant the thorn which flowers every Christmas morn? Did an ancient ghostly hand map the ruins on Abbey land? Is King Arthur buried here with his Lady Guinevere? Is Excalibur, the famous sword, part of a buried treasure hoard? Was the Lady of the Lake a Glastonbury goddess, for goodness sake? Are the eggstones really portals that hide the fairies from us mortals? And have the fairies got a door to a realm beneath the Tor? Have they got a palace there with a king and a golden chair? Are Gog and Magog wise old sages guarding the Tor as oaks of ages? What stories could the yew trees tell in the garden at Chalice Well? Do the ley lines form a grid? And where's the abbey's treasures hid? And is there a dragon with a tail watching over the Holy Grail? There's many a legend and many a tale and lots of lovely goods for sale, crystals, wands and so much more, and pictures of the mystical Tor. So come to Glastonbury and stay a while. Feel the magic. It'll make you smile.
Thank you. Going back to what you said earlier, you wrote poetry for people with grief, did you say? And how do you think it helped?
Well, I spent many years as a professional celebrant organising beautiful ceremonies as a celebration of somebody's life so that they could honour and acknowledge everything that made them special and unique. And I used to run a small organisation in Bristol which actually created funerals and helped people deal with all stages of grief. And it was just a natural part of dealing with that that enabled me to then write the poetry that kind of sort of touched the spot that said the words that they were feeling but weren't always able to say.
Okay. And do you think that poetry is therapeutic for yourself or for other people?
Oh, very much so. Poetry tends to say more than just ordinary words. We seem, you know, when you speak in verse, and I mean, it's no accident that we live in a universe, pardon the pun, there's a rhythm to it, and it seems to touch people in a much deeper place than just general words. And often when we're dealing with grief, it's often that we don't actually know what to say. So if we can find the right words in a poem or a reading, that really does help.
What attracted you to poetry in the first place?
I've always written from the very first time I could pick up a pen when I was probably a toddler. And I remember as a small child, I used to read the books by Enid Blyton, The Enchanted Wood, The Faraway Tree. And I was mesmerised by the character Saucepan Man, who used to speak in verse. And I think that began my love of verse, but I didn't think I could actually write it myself. Often we feel that what we love in somebody else, we don't think we can always do. And then I remember hearing Dolly Parton once on a radio interview, and she was talking about her poetry and her songs, and she said, "I was given the gift of rhyme." And I thought, "You lucky woman, I'd like that gift too." And I suddenly realised that the only way I was going to get that gift was to actually develop it. And once I started, that was it. I couldn't stop. I've written hundreds of poems on all sorts of things, from serious ones about war, peace, food. I wrote one inspired by an American guru, food. Well, I wouldn't call him a guru. He's a food expert. He's written a book called Medicines and Pharmaceuticals. He's probably the pharmacy business's worst nightmare. And I read one of his books, which said something about foodless foods and lifeless drinks. And I ended up writing a poem about that, which was, it starts off, "Foodless foods and lifeless drinks change our moods and how we think." And it kind of goes on like that. So I get inspired by lots of different things.
So do you think it's a case of confidence for some people? Because as you said, you know, you may have had this innate ability, but you have to develop it nonetheless. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose when I started out, I'd often get a couple of words that would rhyme, and then I would have to fit them in and make sure that I had a reasonable meter. I don't stick to the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum, you know, which proper poets would. I like the freestyle, and I've developed my own way of doing it.
And you talk about a range of subjects. Is there something that you probably wouldn't touch on?
I'm not sure about that. It depends what I'm inspired at the time. And I do have a very strong sense of humour, so I often give things an unexpected twist.
And what do you plan to do next? So it's Glastonbury Fringe Festival. Do you have any other festivals or events lined up?
At the moment, I have an invitation to take the Dragons to Puxton Park. We're just sorting out the dates. But I'm finishing off some of my books. I've got The Dragon's Revenge on St George, which is quite amusing. St George, I'll tell you a couple of verses from it. St George has been captured by the dragons, and they've got to make him a friend to stop all the dragon killings going on, because they're the caretakers of the land. And so it's his worst nightmare now. He's surrounded by a group of dragons, and he's convinced he's been beaten, he's going to be eaten. And he doesn't know at this point that they're all vegetarian, and they're winding him up a little bit first of all. So there's a verse in there, for example, there's... lunch, said one, licking her lips. I think we'll have him served with chips, mayonnaise and ketchup too, followed by some rhubarb stew. And another one says, sometimes a tasty saint is nice with curry sauce and egg fried rice. So on. So there's all sorts of this little story that goes on. And of course they make him a friend in the end, and they take him on dragon flights and so on. So it's quite a fun story.
Do you like poetry or stories with a moral to them?
I think most of them do have. Well, certainly mine do. They all have a little hidden message. I mean, I've got another one about Dooley the dragon who couldn't fly and how he learned to. And while he's going through the frustrations of not being able to get himself off the ground, he ends up learning how to play the flute. And he wouldn't have learned how to play the flute if he'd been able to fly straight away. So there's, you know, it's a perseverance thing.
Okay. And could you tell us when you are performing at the Glastonbury Fringe Festival?
They've got me all over the place, kind of, you know, at the different venues in the, mostly in the town at their open mic tents and so on. So it's, but they do have a website on the Glastonbury Fringe. I can't remember exactly what it is at the moment, but if you just put in a search for the Glastonbury Fringe, if anybody wants to hear any of my poems, they can go to my website, which is poolofmagic.com. And there's some SoundCloud links that will give you some of my poems. There's a couple of WI ones. There's one, a very funny one about women with whiskers. There's also an interview I did with an American broadcasting company, and that's called It's Rainmaking Time, I think was the name of their station. That's gone out to about 20,000 people in America, and that tells you some of the stories and legends of Glastonbury.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you very much, Carol, for joining us.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Have fun.
And you. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, John Tiley, Joanne Fowler, Maurice Kirk and Carol Paul. And to studio engineer Dave Hosenker. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband co-op production and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Angela Bilassi, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
That's the sound of the beast.